Welcome back to Trial Bible, where we break down the gospel of great lawyering with attorneys who don't just try cases, they set precedents. And today's guest, she's not just an attorney. She's a force of nature. She's known for turning uphill battles into landmark wins, for delivering arguments so sharp they could cross-examine themselves, and for making juries lean in like she's telling the only story that matters. In a profession full of talkers, she's a real deal closer. Mary Jo Adamy, it is such a pleasure to have you on the show. Welcome.
Thank you. And thank you for having me. You know, this podcast that you're doing is just phenomenal. There's not a lot of it out there. And I think it's invaluable in our profession to get these stories out. So pleasure to be here.
I appreciate that. Well, first off, we have to congratulate you. You've recently had an incredible verdict in Nassau County. And before we dig into the details of it, I'm going to ask you very openly, $60 million in Nassau County. When you heard the jury say it, what was in your mind at that time?
You know, for Nassau County, in and of itself, that verdict is unheard of. But deep down, I knew that the damages that my client sustained, no matter what county he was in, the damages were commensurate with the verdict. And so I felt good about that. But I must tell you that I got emotional when that verdict came in. And I've had dozens and dozens of verdicts in my career. And this has been the only time where I was so moved at what the jury had done in that particular county, in this particular case, for a family that in all of my years of practice, going on 28 years, there has not been a client who has needed this help more. So it was very moving. It was very emotional. I believe I mentioned to you in our discussions that afterwards, the jury waited about an hour and a half for me and my associate, Aaron Sir, to come out. And even that was emotional. There were embraces and they were with my clients for about 2.5 hours on the steps of the Nassau County Courthouse, exchanging numbers. There was a group text that they started. Afterwards, they went out. So in Nassau County, it was a big deal and it was emotional all around.
We're at a loss of words when we experience that moment that you're talking about to not just get the verdict that you want and you feel is rightly deserved, but when you know the person that it's going to, when you know that every single dollar was accounted for and this person so desperately needs the money, it's inexplainable. The feeling that we get at that point in the trial, it's an inexplainable feeling. And the fact that you're saying the jury waited and stuck around, it speaks volumes. And I'm going to, you know, say it directly to you. It speaks volumes to your work on this case. The fact that you got them to connect to what it was that they were doing, you empowered them, and you really connected them to your client in a courtroom, which is no easy feat. It says a lot about you as a trial attorney. That's why we have you on here. That's why I want to dig into what it is that you did. Give us a little bit of tips and tricks that some of us may use so that we can all be successful in this field. I want to set things up a little bit. This is a medical malpractice case. Can you give us a brief overview as to who your client was and why it was that he sought legal help from your office?
Sure. So my client's name is David Gengarum, who was a gentleman in his early 60s, full-time working as an electrical mechanic at JFK Airport. Came to this country from Guyana for a better life. His wife was also from there, met in the United States, and moved to Nassau County. He was having lower back pain. A very typical, common condition that pain management physicians, who the defendant was, Dr. Robert Ayadeveo, was a pain management physician. But one of the most common, if not the most common conditions that pain management physicians treat. And he was getting a spinal epidural injection, which is essentially an injection of a steroid into the epidural space. And it takes some pressure off the nerves and relieves pain for an indeterminate amount of time.
And so Mr. Garam had been treating with Dr. Aya DeVeo for quite some time, about 2 years,
and was having a series of spinal epidural injections leading up to the final injection, which was in November of 2019, and which was the subject of this action. On that particular day, the procedure was seemingly uneventful. This was a big part of the trial, but according to the operative report of Dr. Aya DeVeo, her procedure was uneventful. When Mr. Gangaram woke up from mild sedation, which is what they use for these procedures, they said, okay, David, sit up. And David went to sit up and he couldn't move his legs. He had no feeling from his waist down. Frightened, he looked at the nurse and said, is this normal? Should this be happening? And he was subsequently transferred to NYU Winthrop Hospital, where after a series of imaging, he was diagnosed as having what's called a spinal infarct. And that spinal infarct is what caused him to be permanently paralyzed from the waist down.
This is one of those tragic stories of you go in for a normal routine procedure, something that he has in fact done with this specific doctor a number of times, right? He's gotten a number of injections from this doctor. And on this one instance, you go in for what you think is, you know, back relief is what you're going to come out with it. And you end up permanently disabled. You hear a story like this. You are part of a great firm in New York. What do you kind of go through when you hear an intake like that as to what could have gone wrong? How do you start preparing your case right from inception?
So this case was unusual in that for the first, I would say 7, 8, or 9 procedures that Mr. Gangaram had with Dr. Aya DeVeo, the medical records indicated he was using a steroid known as a particulate steroid. And it's getting a little bit granular, but it's going to answer your question. But there's two types of steroids that are used in these types of procedures. One is called a particulate, and one is called a non-particulate steroid. A particulate steroid, you can imagine, is something that has particles, doesn't dissolve in water. And a non-particulate steroid dissolves in water. It's just like water. It's a soluble substance. And the literature, which played a huge role in this trial, and which pain management physicians have been studying this for literally decades, and one of my experts, Dr. Alan Kay from LSU, is one of the leading authorities in this field in terms of mechanisms of how during a spinal epidural injection, you can get a spinal infarct. And there has been study after study after study, and prior to and up through including the time of trial, there has never been a confirmed reported case of a spinal infarct during a spinal epidural injection with a non-particulate steroid that causes what we call a embolic stroke. Now, I know there's a lot going on there. If you want, I'll expand a little bit more, but to come full circle to your question, where the case originally came to us, knowing that there's an abundance of literature on this specific topic, the first thing we did is say, what type of steroid did Dr. Aya DeVeo use? And this became, to me, one of the most crucial parts of the trial.
for the first 8 or 9 injections that Mr. Gangaram had, the medical records indicate that Dr. Iadavayo used the particulate kind, which is the kind that can coalesce and cause an embolic stroke, and of which the literature advises not to use. So despite that, Dr. Iadavayo chose to use a particulate steroid known to cause an embolic stroke if and only if that steroid gets inadvertently, mistakenly, negligently injected into an artery that leads to the spinal cord. So to put it a different way, if you inject either a non-particulate steroid or a particulate steroid into an artery mistakenly, but it doesn't lead to the spinal cord, no harm, no foul. Nothing's going to happen and you're not going to get an infarct. If, however, you inject the particulate kind into a vessel that it should not be in, an artery that leads to the spinal cord, you can and you will get a spinal infarct.
So you saw immediately, you got the medical records, and you knew at least the ingredients were there for this catastrophe to have occurred. You see a doctor using the particulate steroid, which is, we're going to call it the wrong steroid so we don't confuse people, the steroid that could cause these infarcts. Infarct is a stroke, another word for a stroke that we use here. So we have the ingredients of a disabled male who wasn't disabled when he went in for the surgery. This particulate steroid is being used by this doctor in this office. And so now we have something to continue this case on. Fair enough?
Yes. Up until November 18, 2019, where things took a little bit of a turn.
Tell us what happened.
Yeah. When we looked at the actual procedure note of the day that he sustained this infarct, coincidentally or not coincidentally, the office record indicate that on this particular day, go figure, he wrote that he used the non-particulate steroid, the steroid that cannot and does not cause an embolic stroke. So the red flags went up. So you have procedure 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, where he's using a steroid that is not recommended for use. It wasn't contraindicated. It just was not recommended for use, because if you put your needle where it shouldn't be, what happened to David Gangaram could happen. On this particular day, what an awful coincidence that the notes stated that he used this non-particulate steroid. So we had to investigate. Part of that investigation, and to me, this was probably the most pivotal point in the trial, we retained an expert neuroradiologist who specializes in this type of imaging. And we had him examine the post-procedure MRI, as well as other studies done to identify the infarct. And based upon his findings, his name is Dr. Raz, he's from NYU Medical Center. Based upon Dr. Raz's findings, he was able to, number one, eliminate at what level this didn't happen. So Mr. Gangaram's injections were in the lower part of the spine, what we call the lumbar spine, so L3 and L4. He was able to say, we know it didn't happen at L3, and this is why, which leaves L4. And then he was able to say, not because it was his opinion, not because he said, I say so, but based upon the imaging, which we highlighted and showed to the jury, this number one had to have been an embolic stroke. Embolic meaning something that travels from the site of the injection to somewhere. Think of a PE that starts in the leg. You have a DVT and it travels to the lung. We call that a PE. So an embolic stroke is something that travels. A thrombotic stroke is when you have local damage at the site of the injection. So you might have some bleeding. You might have a tear. He was able to eliminate, based upon the imaging, a thrombotic etiology to this stroke,
which leaves us with an embolic stroke. Now, what has been the only identified, reported, confirmed cause of an embolic spinal infarct during a epidural spinal injection? A particulate steroid. And so what we were able to do in combination with Dr. Raz's testimony regarding the imaging and Dr. Alan Kay, our pain management expert, who wrote about this specific issue, is this infarct could not have happened in the absence of malpractice. We can eliminate all other mechanisms of injury, and we did. Thrombotic kind, even in the embolic kind, we eliminated plaque, dissection, things of that nature, and that this had to have been an embolic stroke caused by a particulate steroid. So to answer your question, early on, getting that expert retained to look at the imaging was the key to the case in the beginning and what allowed us to go forward. And to me, wound up being the pivotal part of the trial that allowed a jury to say the medicine was complex, but it allowed a jury to say, I understand this. We can eliminate this. And this is why. And we had some PowerPoint images, Gennady, that were just outstanding in terms of the real imaging that we displayed to the jury. And I spoke to them after, and they said, in the beginning, this was complicated stuff. And they said, we got it. He injected this. It went from here to here. It couldn't have been that. It had to have been that. And so I think in terms of the case coming in, getting that radiology expert retained right away wound up being, to me, the most pivotal part of the case.
Something I hear a lot when I talk about medical malpractice cases is you hear it's always a battle of the experts. I think it's more than that. I think it's more than just the battle of the experts, but really coinciding with what you're saying, it's telling the story the correct way and making sure the jury understands what could be very complicated medical jargon in a very simple fashion. And really what you're doing is very similar to what a doctor does. When you go in and a patient has a complaint, they're trying to rule out certain things. Rather than immediately tell you what it is that's causing the pain, they're ruling out. And it sounds like that's exactly what this expert neuroradiologist did for you. He ruled out it cannot be anything but this particulate steroid that was inserted into the artery that caused the infarct. Is that right?
That's right. And it not only was a way for the jury to understand the medicine, but it allowed me at the conclusion of the case in summation to say, ladies and gentlemen, this is what happened, not because I say so, not because it's my expert's opinion, not because he says, well, it had to have been, because he showed you on the imaging that it could not have been any other mechanism of injury. And the other part of this case, Gennady, that was really important is we not only had to prove that, number one, it was an embolic stroke, that number two, Dr. Ayadeveo had to have used the particulate steroid, but we had to show that his office note was wrong. And as litigators, that's a tough sell. You had a typewritten note in the chart using EMR, electronic medical records, where Dr. Ayadeveo wrote, non-particulate steroid used, you know, no issues. And so what we were able to do is not call him a liar. We didn't say he was not being truthful. What we said is, based upon the imaging, Dr. Ayadeveo's note cannot be what happened. He might be mistaken. Maybe he believed he used a non-particulate steroid, but his note cannot be wrong, and this is why. And so because we had the imaging to rely upon, I didn't have to go in and say to a jury, he's lying. We never used those words. We never said he was not being honest. We just said his note cannot be true.
That's a really good trial tip that continues. I see it all the time in the trials that I'm handling, in mistakes that defendants are making, defense counsel's making, and in conversations with other trial attorneys. When you take the harsh position of wanting to call someone a liar, I find that it just doesn't sit well with jurors. No one wants to hear you or anyone else call someone else a liar. So it's really part of your strategy here in that I'm not going to call you a liar. I'm just going to put forth the evidence to say maybe it was a mistake. It's a softer way of saying you're fucking lying.
Yeah.
This is why.
Yeah, it's not only a softer way for the jury to hear it, but it's also difficult to deliver. You know, he's a liar. It just doesn't even come off well. What I think was really important in this case was the testimony of Mr. Gangaram and the timing of the note. And it allowed me to never after ever have to say to a jury, he's lying. But Mr. Gangaram wakes up and he looks at the nurse and says, should this be happening? Is this normal? And they called Dr. Iadavea when he came in the procedure room. And when David testified to this, I asked him to just slow down. Take the jury into this procedure room with you, step by step, because it was a crucial moment, and I'll tell you why. But Dr. Iadavea comes in the room and says, hey, Dave, what's going on? They were on a first-name basis. Mr. Gangaram had brought him a bottle of Guyanese rum at one point. They had a good working relationship up until this point. And even during the trial, it was difficult, I think, for them to see each other. But he says, David, what's going on? And David says, I can't feel my legs. I can't feel my legs from the waist down. David testified to this, that Dr. Iadavea looked at him with a look of concern, said nothing, left the room. And this was, the procedure ended, I don't remember times, Gennady, so just forgive me on this, but let's say procedure ended at 2 o'clock p.m. when he woke up from anesthesia. Let's assume that was 2 o'clock p.m. So David's testifying that Dr. Iadavea leaves the room and goes back to his office. At 2:12 p.m., there's an addendum in the record. And the addendum says, patient tolerated procedure well, but woke up with some weakness. Now, number one, and this was a credibility issue that, Dr. Iadavea handed me a softball. When you have a man who wakes up from a procedure who cannot move from the waist down, that's more than a little weakness. And so immediately it was Dr. Iadavea minimizing what had happened. Number two, the note said, we'll monitor. What we surmised, what a jury believed, is that Dr. Iadavea, who was aware of the literature, conceded at his deposition, which I was able to use at trial, that the use of particulate steroids has been known to cause spinal infarcts. If you inadvertently, mistakenly inject a needle into an artery, you can cause a spinal infarct. He was aware of all this. And so I never said to the jury, ladies and gentlemen, at 2:13 p.m., when he realized his patient had been paralyzed, when he realized that procedure 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, and 8, every single procedure leading up to this one, he used the steroid that was not recommended for use. What was the addendum? What did he go in there and change in his note? We know from the testimony of the expert that he could not have used a non-particulate steroid. And so by combining the testimony of Dr. K on how this is caused, the imaging, the timing of his note, the addendum, his minimizing what happened to Mr. Gangaram afterwards, and one other point, which was really important in terms of a jury believing
that he could not have used what he said he used. He picks up the phone and calls over to NYU Winthrop and says, I'm sending my client over. I just had a patient who underwent a spinal epidural infarct. And oh, by the way, NYU Winthrop, just so you know, I used a non-particulate. And NYU wrote in the chart, you know, patient coming, spinal infarct from a non-particulate. And so at trial, defense counsel said, ladies and gentlemen, see, look at the NYU chart. Even they said he used a non-particulate. Well, number one, who's the only one who could testify as to what he used? And number two, you know, doth thou protest too much, right? So he was covering all of his bases. And there were some conversations that he had with Bibi Gangaram, David's wife, where he was like, I use the non-particulate kind, Bibi. I swear. So all of these things allowed me to not have to walk into the court and say he's a liar. He falsified his record. He doctored his record. I never used any of that terminology. I was able to say, regardless of the why and the how, his note cannot be right. And the addendum at Court 13 wound up being really, really important.
Is that the theme that you continue to come back to going into this trial? Is that we have to find a way to continue to show this jury that this note is not correct?
Yeah. And I have to tell you, we made a column of all of the reasons we wanted to present, all the evidence we wanted to present to a jury to show them why this note can't be right. It was a big column. You know, it was a large column. So from jump, from my opening statement all the way through, it's, this is what this note says. If that note is accurate, we shouldn't be here. You should send David Gangaram home with nothing. But this, ladies and gentlemen, is why you are going to learn after 3-4 weeks why his note cannot be accurate. It cannot be accurate. And what really happened is A, B, and C. So that was always the theme, as opposed to liar, liar, pants on fire.
But I like that one too.
No, I really wanted to say that, but, you know.
I want to go back walking into jury selection. Again, we're in a not so plaintiff-friendly venue. You have an immigrant for a client from Guyana, right? He was from Guyana.
Yes.
Okay. And you have a note, a medical record note, that if true, your entire case falls apart. What are you doing in jury selection? What is your demeanor in jury selection? Who were you trying to keep? Who were you trying to get off? What are you saying to them to prepare them for your theme?
You know, I think one of the biggest issues that I've wadeered about, just because something's written, does that mean it's true? How many times have we seen, not in terms of litigation or medical malpractice, but our everyday lives, and I'm going to give you something totally benign, but you go to the doctor's office, you know, and you weigh 140 and it says you weigh 340. You don't weigh 340. So you can have a mistake in the medical record that's advertent or inadvertent. A lot of times you go for an annual physical and you say, I've been having some stomach problems for the past week. And the medical record says you've been having stomach problems for the past 6 months. You say, I haven't been having stomach problems for the past 6 months. And a lot of times it's an innocent mistake. You know, a lot of times it isn't. So I wanted jurors who would ask questions and delve into things and say, does this make sense? And part of that is I use scale questions. You know, on a scale of 1 to 10, 10 being doctors can do no harm, 0 or 1 being doctors can do no right. Where do you stand? And that also became a pivotal question, because a lot of people, my old school mother included, she's 75. She's of that generation where, Mayor, the doctor said I have 3 arms, so I must have 3 arms. And so a lot of it was,
you know, really, really exploring with these potential jurors how they feel about somebody who wears a white coat. And while that's true in any medical malpractice case, here specifically, me knowing without the jury knowing that that issue of Dr. Iadomeo potentially changing his note was going to be so crucial. So a lot of it was based upon just because he's a physician, does it mean that he's right? Does it mean he can't make mistakes? And then more granular is, will you challenge the evidence that you hear and see as opposed to saying it must be true? So I spent a lot of time on it. I wanted smart jurors here because I knew the medicine was in our favor. I knew that if they just paid attention and put the pieces together, it would turn out. Now, it was a big battle to, number one, show that he falsified his record. And number two, the medicine was really, really, really complicated. It took me a while to be able to not only understand it, but be able to talk about it fluently. So I wanted really, really smart jurors. And I was astounded, Gennady, when this was done, talking to these jurors on the courthouse steps. They were like, yeah, bozo, Dr. Brady. There was no spinal artery at L3, L4. Like, duh. I mean, I was really like, they were using the terminology and talking to me about it. And so I think, you know, yes, as a litigator, a plaintiff's attorney, a defense attorney, you do have to deliver the medicine in a way that's comprehensible. And we were able to do that. But from jury selection, I wanted people who I knew were going to be able to understand some pretty complex things and not just accept something, you know, as true.
I want to ask you about the defendant's position. Did you know what their position was going to be going into trial? Did it stay the same throughout the trial? Did they have to scramble at any point? I know that they have a record that they are praying will be, you know, will be their saving grace. But other than that, what is their position?
They were, in my opinion, erroneously banking on the note saving the day. He used a non-particulate steroid. With a non-particulate steroid, there's some causes of this that are not malpractice. You don't have to inject it into an artery. You can have an embolism. You can have plaque that gets dislodged. You can have some bleeding. You can get a little tear. And even my own experts conceded none of that is malpractice. So I think Mr. Brady went into this saying, ladies and gentlemen, this theory she's concocting is bullshit. And you're going to see why. Particulates, non-particulates, it's all horseshit. Almost intimating to the jury that I'm wasting their time. And I think that the defense was, now that the case is over.
Yeah, tell it to us straight. Tell us really what you think.
Yeah, now that the case is over and there is an appeal pending, I think that they realize what a mistake that was, number one. Number two, they had no expert to talk about the imaging. And the imaging was crucial. And I think that was a big mistake. I do not think that they thought in a million years we would be able to show that that note had to have been wrong.
Just for the audience, this is they didn't hire their own neuroradiologist expert.
Correct. They had no expert to talk about the imaging. They did have an expert whose name was Michael Weinberger, who was a pain management specialist from Columbia, who was not trained to interpret or read spinal angiograms. It was a spinal angiogram and an MRI, both of which were the most compelling evidence, but he wasn't trained to interpret spinal angiograms. So they called one expert. And I'm going to try to not sound pompous in this, but at the end of my cross-examination of their expert, he became my expert. His testimony was, my opinion is I don't really have an opinion. Number two, I don't know how this was caused. Embolic, thrombolic, plaque. I'm really not sure. I don't know if he used a particulate or a non-particulate. I'm assuming his note to be true. I believe him. And we really don't know what causes these things. Can I sit down now? And so I made a huge deal about that on summation, that they couldn't even find an expert to come to court to say, ladies and gentlemen, my opinion to a reasonable degree of medical certainty is, number one, he had to have used what he said he used. And number two, this is why. And this was a bit of what I call sharp practice. But on summation, Mr. Brady said the following.
Brady is defense counsel.
Mr. Brady is defense counsel. Bruce Brady, very experienced, esteemed, highly regarded defense counsel. And I have absolutely nothing negative to say about him. We worked well together throughout the trial. And he's fantastic. With that being said, he said to the jury during summation, ladies and gentlemen, Mary Jo is probably going to tell you, stand up here and say, my God, why didn't they get a radiologist? Because they couldn't find one. And he actually had the audacity to look at the jury and say, you know what, ladies and gentlemen, we don't get to know who she's going to call and what the experts are going to say until they say it. So we didn't have an opportunity to get an expert to talk about the imaging. Well, this was something I'm not proud of, and I was talking to your wife about this, but I slammed my hand on the desk. I was so enraged at what he said, because for anyone here who doesn't practice in our field, it's what's called CPLR 3101. We get precluded if we don't lay all of our cards out on the table.
No surprises at trial. Everyone knows that.
Yeah, so this isn't trial by ambush. And it's interesting because afterwards, I went up to Judge Steinman, who was our trial judge, and said, I want a limiting instruction. I want the jury to know A, B, and C. So he said, everybody calm down. We didn't have enough time for my summation, so we had to come back in the morning. And that night, I said, why am I doing a limiting instruction? I'm going to use this to my advantage. And the next morning, more calm than I was the day before, I came in, I delivered my summation. I said to the jury, do you really think that that's how this works? That I can come in here and do whatever I want and go rogue? And why do you think that they never, you know, retained an expert? You know, because they couldn't. So I was able to take something that to me was sharp practice, a low blow, a desperate attempt to explain their own deficiencies, and really flip it. And it worked in our favor.
I love the raw emotion that sometimes comes out. And I have been on both sides where it was good for the jury to see. And I have to say, I've been on the side where I let too much emotion come out and it was bad. And there is a very fine line of showing your emotion in the courtroom. But it sounds like that moment played out in your favor.
Yeah. You know, going back, would I have reacted the way I did again? No. I would have tried to calm my emotions. Did it matter here? Thankfully, no. But there could come a time where it did matter. There was another instance where Mr. Gangaram was testifying. The Gangarams called their insurance company, their medical insurance company, because every time you do a procedure, they bill for the type of steroid you used. So we said, wait a minute, what was Dr. Ayadeveo billing? And not coincidentally, he billed for procedure one. It said particulate. Procedure two, it said particulate. Procedure three, it said et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Guess what procedure he didn't bill for? At one point, Mr. Brady was trying to say that Mrs. Gangaram called the insurance company, found out he was using something and hid it. And it was just the way that the testimony came out. But it was another moment where I, and slammed my hand on the desk. So it's hard. it's difficult, especially when you know that your adversary is doing something sharp, something they shouldn't. It's one thing to cross-examine. It's one thing to be a bulldog, to be vigilant, to get in there and tear it up. I do the same thing. It's another thing to behave in that way where you know that you shouldn't and you cross the line. Was it reversible error? No. Did Mr. Brady know better? Yes. Did I tell him during the break? I did tell him. But I'm half Italian, half Lebanese, so it's hard for me to curtail my emotions.
You know, you bring up a good point. It's something that, again, I deal with as a younger attorney, always going against people that have been doing it longer. You have to call them out on their bullshit. And if you don't, they will continue to do it. And there has to be a stop to it. And I tell younger attorneys, you have to start doing this in depositions. A lot of things go on in depositions, and attorneys are sizing each other up. It happened to me when I was just starting, and I saw people getting away with it, and I was calling my mentor saying, can he do this? Can they ask this? You know, what's the procedure here? And every time I was being told, no, they can't. No, you need to stop them. And after I started kind of mentioning to them, listen, I know what you're trying to pull here. Don't try it again.
Yeah.
Or we're going to go to a judge about it. There's a very fine line of trying a case exactly like you're saying. So I encourage everyone who's at trial, if the other side is doing something that they should not be doing, you better tell them right away, cut it out.
I think that's an important point, especially for young attorneys who I hope are watching, you know, your podcasts, which are amazing. But number one, not just at trial at depositions, but number two, when you're starting your practice, you know, you have one opportunity to convey to your adversaries, to the bench, the type of litigator you are. Are you someone who's going to fight everything? Say no just to say no. Or are you someone where in 2 years from now, 5 years from now, your adversaries are going to say, Miss Adamy is someone, if she says something, she means it. We need an adjournment. My dog died. Mary Jo will give it to us. Mary Jo's reasonable. Without them walking all over you, but how you set the tone, both in terms of trial, dealing with a hostile adversary, dealing with a hostile witness, at deposition, dealing with a hostile adversary, and even beginning your career and the type of attorney that you want to be and the reputation, I think it's instrumental from jump to set the stage and decide who you want to be in this community. Because as you know, it's a small community. And especially with medical malpractice, personal injury, it's a small community. We all know each other. So I think that's really, really important for young attorneys, a lesson for them to learn.
Reputation is everything. And it comes to settling also. Stick to your word. If you're saying that, you know, something is the bottom line, that's got to be the bottom line. As soon as you say something and you go back on it, your credibility and reputation is no longer that you stand on your word. So I appreciate you bringing that up. I want to turn to the visuals. I know that jurors love visuals, and especially in a medical malpractice case, you said that they really got it in this case. So I do want to share some of the visuals that you had in this case. And if you could just kind of walk through some of it with us to help explain this particular, you know, we see here the spinal anatomy. Why don't you take the floor on this?
Yeah. So this image was an image that we used to just demonstrate, number one, the basic spinal anatomy to the jury, what a vertebral body is, where the spinal cord is, where the aorta is. And in particular, for each disc, you know, we had the axial view. So this was just to give the jury a basic understanding of the spinal anatomy and the arterial anatomy within the spine. And then just parenthetically, we matched this to Mr. Gangaram's actual MRI imaging. So for example, if there was an intercostal artery that emanated from L3 in the image, it was based on his real anatomy. So we were able to just give the jury what I call a, you know, medicine 101. To just let them know, number one, where things are, and then how this procedure is formed and in terms of just generalizations first, and then we were able to concentrate on Mr. Gangara.
These are the MRIs that you're referring to that you showed them.
These are the MRIs, which I think that these MRIs were really, really compelling because we had this MRI imposed next to the actual the diagram that we used. And this particular MRI was important because while you may not be able to see it without a mouse, it shows how big this infarct was. And so the top of the thoracic spine, all the way down to the lumbar spine, that's how large his infarct was. Why was this important? The infarct was so profound that it caused David to be, number one, paralyzed from the waist down, number two, permanently paralyzed, impotent, incontinent of urine, and incontinent of bowel and bladder incontinence. So we were able to show the jury how profound his infarct was, and that if this was a thrombotic stroke, you would not have had that huge dark area going up and down the spine. And it was important for a couple of reasons that we'll get to on some of the next slides. This one I really liked, Gennady, because it just shows the jury how the procedure is performed. And if you remember, we had to not only show the jury the type of infarct this was, but we had to show them that when Dr. Iadavello used what had to have been a particulate steroid, it's not just that he used it, but he had to inadvertently
go into the artery.
So he had to place his needle not where it should be, but into an artery. And this is an illustration that in 5, 10, 15, 20 years from now, I think you'll remember, you can close your eyes and picture a needle going into a red vessel that leads to the spinal cord. And when I use the terms leads to the spinal cord, by definition, that's an embolic stroke. And so you can have that image as a jury in your mind while you're listening to the testimony, while Dr. K is saying it had to have been embolic, and this is why. And when Dr. Raz is testifying about the imaging, you have that image. Okay, I have this needle, goes into these two, in between these two spacers. Some of these spaces have a little artery, some don't. If you get the one that has an artery and it travels, you can get this profound stroke. You know, and that's simplifying it, really. It's oversimplifying it, but it's really what the case was about. So this illustration shows how mechanically that needle gets injected into an artery. And if that artery, and that's that red line that's going all the way up, if that artery leads to the spinal cord, you are in trouble.
This is another one of those images where it looks like you're comparing his actual spine to help the jury understand how this whole process works, right?
Yeah. You know, if I could pick one image that I think was a pivotal point in both the testimony and why the jury found in our favor, it's this image. And I'm going to explain why. But Mr. Gangaram has a spinal injury angiogram at NYU, who was not a defendant. They were just the facility who he was transferred to and who made the diagnosis. And the interpreting radiologist of the angiogram said that at L4, he did not see one of those arteries leading to the spinal cord. So you can have damage to something, but unless it leads to the spinal cord, it's no harm, no foul. And so in the report, not the actual images, in the report, it said at L4, there's no spinal artery leading to the, there's no artery leading to the spinal artery. And so Mr. Brady was able, or tried to say, look at L4. They're talking about L4 all day long. There's no artery that leads to the spinal cord. So it could not have been L4. Well, guess what? We have Dr. Raz. We retained Dr. Raz from jump before the case went into suit. And lo and behold, in this picture, you will see that those yellow arrows, this is not a PowerPoint of some image that we doctored. I did not have an illustrator do this. This image shows an artery leading from L4, which is where we say the needle entered the artery. You see this small vessel leading all the way up to the anterior spinal artery. And NYU missed it. We didn't blame them. They didn't do anything wrong. The damage was already done. He had already infarcted. He was already paralyzed. A spinal angiogram just is a mapping tool to tell you what vessels are where. And so I had this blown up to the, you know, umpteenth degree, so large with these yellow arrows saying, look at this vessel. It doesn't matter that NYU missed it, but here it is. This is the vessel that came out of L4 and that leads to the spinal artery, and the inadvertent injection of that particulate steroid is how we get to the infarct.
I'm curious, for my own sake, when you're showing this to the jury, is it on a screen? Are you zooming in, or is it blown up an image on one of those poster boards, or is it a combination of everything?
To younger attorneys or older attorneys who don't try cases yet, you know what your judge does. Judge Steinman, we knew in advance, has an electronic courtroom. And so we were able to plug into the courtroom system and say to the judge, okay, hit the button. And everything was electronic. Not only was there a large screen behind the witness stand, but every juror had their own TV monitor in front of them. So it was great. So all this is being done not only on a large screen electronically, but they had it in front of them. Parenthetically, we had old school blow-ups of this made because, for obvious reasons, if something goes wrong, you're fucked and you have absolutely nothing to show to a jury. But this was all done on a really, really large screen. I had the arrows there, but I also had Dr. Raz do what you're doing, and he had a pointer. So he was able to move the pointer around. And I have to tell you, the jury was like this.
Bleed all the way in.
Yeah, they wanted to understand it. And, you know, as trial attorneys, you obviously watch your witness, but you watch the jury too. And they wanted to understand it. And, you know, I got a lot of this, you know, and shaking heads. And on cross-examination, I got a lot of this. So I can't stress enough how much the imaging and the medical illustrations here made such a difference in the jury understanding it, and then finally concluding that what he wrote in his note could not be true.
When you come across a large verdict like this, I always find that there's some anger inside the jurors in terms of what's being presented to them on the defense side. You have to get them to a point where they understand the big number is the only justice here. Was there something that you did on cross-examination of Dr. Aya DeVeo that helped get the jurors to really not like this guy? Or is there something that he did in the answers to your questions that allowed them to get to that kind of emotional state?
When I do my depositions, I don't just have an outline of what I want to answer. I very carefully craft my questions at deposition, thinking 3 years in advance, because I know when I ask a doctor a question, I'm going to be reading this question 3 years from now at trial. Some of my partners tease me about it because I literally will write out, would you agree, doctor, that the use of particulate steroids has been known to cause a spinal infarct if injected into a artery? Yes. So at trial, it's not rocket science what I do. I take my deposition question, doctor, would you agree that it hasn't been known? I'm sorry, doctor, maybe I didn't hear you. So let me ask you one more time. And you can't twist the words. You have to say it exactly if you want to really, really impeach him the way you said it at deposition. Doctor, would you agree that the use of particulates has been known to, it hasn't been known, it could happen. And so that was one time. when I did that 25 times, 26 times, and a jury is like, my God, you said it 2 years ago. Mary Jo's not throwing you, giving you a trick question. Just say yes. I think it made a big difference. I also made a big deal about, so metadata, for those of you who don't know what it is a way in which to go into an electronic medical record and ascertain the timing and the content of anyone who went into a chart and made a change. And we requested that metadata, didn't get it. And I made a huge deal about that at the time of trial. And I was able to say, if that metadata showed that he went in at 2:13 p.m. and never changed the steroid that he used, why didn't they bring it in? Why aren't you seeing it? And so I made a big deal about the metadata, and Dr. Iodivino was like, I left the company and guys took over, you know, so it was a lot of excuse. And so I think if you add all of that stuff together, I think a jury found that he was not credible. Another example, Gennady, is, you know, when he wrote in the note at 2:13, when he knew Mr. Gangaram was paralyzed, tolerated procedure well, but woke up with some weakness. You know, I made a big deal about it. And I think stuff like that, generally speaking, in terms of cross-examination, a jury responds to that and collectively said, wait a minute, this guy may not have been totally forthcoming in his note without me have to calling him a liar.
Before we get to the damages portion of it, I just want to point out this is a significant verdict. What was the offer pre-trial?
So it was what we call a no-pay. So there was a no-pay means even if I said to defense counsel, I'll take $5, a no-pay is a no-pay. So there was not only a no-pay, but it was no consent. And so Dr. Iadomeo had something called a consent policy where he has to actually give his written consent in order for the insurance company to, if they want to, enter into settlement negotiations. So it was a no pay and a no consent, which as a trial attorney, I like those cases better.
Me too.
Right? There's nothing to decide. There's no distractions. Should I take $1 million? Should I take $2 million? You don't have any of that. You're going to go in and take a verdict. And in my mind, I'm like, I'm going in and taking a verdict. So I like those cases. I like those cases better.
I agree with you. When they dig their heels into their position, it makes our life much easier. And I think the jury very clearly sees what's going on during the trial when they take that kind of position. So I want to get to the damages aspect of this case. I know we've been saying, you know, kind of nonchalantly, he was disabled post-accident, but tell us a little bit of the key moments during this trial that the jury heard where you really dialed in on what his life was like post-incident.
Mr. Gangaram wound up having permanent paralysis as a result of his spinal infarct. The extent of his paralysis was commensurate with a large infarct that he had. He was impotent. He was incontinent of bladder and incontinent of bowel. I very, very carefully had Mr. Gangaram convey to a jury from the moment he wakes up in the morning until he goes to bed at night what his day is like. And we did a day in the life video, too, that we played in terms of visuals, both still photographs and videos while he was testifying. So we had a video of it probably was, in actuality, 45 minutes of Mr. Gangaram's aide taking him from the bed to his wheelchair, just to go from his bed to his wheelchair to get him then to the bathroom. And I broke that down. And then maneuvering his wheelchair through very narrow door frames in their small home to get him to the bathroom. And then once he's in the bathroom, you know, getting him washed, transferred, using suppositories because he can't move his balls on his own. You know, he has a bag, a catheter bag. He used to self-catheterize. Now he has an indwelling catheter. That whole morning process to this day takes Mr. Gangaram about 3 hours. And I had him take us through that. Now, Mr. Gangaram, if you've ever met him, is probably the sweetest man you'll ever meet. And I think this was why a jury was able to relate to him. And if I can, I'd like to tell you just one little snippet of how I think, rather than talk about bladder incontinence, bowel incontinence, a jury connected with him and afterwards embraced him and cried with him the way that they did. But he's testifying that during the day, his wife, Bibi, has to do all the cooking, and he sits in his wheelchair. And he says, you know, Bibi will wheel me in and I'll help her with the dinner preparation. And I heard this and I'm like, help her with the dinner preparation. And I must say, I panicked a little bit. He can't help her with dinner preparation. He can't walk. He can't move from the waist down. He's wheelchair bound. So I'm like, what is he saying? So I'm watching him, and he's looking at the jury, and he's telling the story, and he says, what she'll do is she'll get a bunch of vegetables and she'll put them on a board, and she'll put the board on my wheelchair on the platform, and I'll cut the vegetables. And he looks, and he's looking at the jury, and under his breath, he looks at them and he goes, she makes me work for my food. And it was just a moment where they were laughing, and it wasn't, they weren't laughing at him. They were laughing with him. And you couldn't prep this if you tried. I didn't know where he was going, but it was just like my heart swelled up, only because I knew that this was really David. This was him speaking from the heart. He wasn't performing. This was actually him, and a jury was captivated by him. And the second he said that, it was like the whole tenor of the courtroom just kind of changed. Like, they were like, you know, and they related to him because of the way he told the story, as opposed to saying, you know, I sit there, I can't help her, so I have to cut the vegetables. It's just the way he said it. And I think that, you know, you use the word anger verdict. I think an anger verdict would have been 160 million. I think 60 million, when you talk about the life care planner and the millions and millions and millions of dollars it would take to care for David, whether he was at his home or elsewhere, I think it was commensurate with what happened to him. But I think little moments like that, I think, allowed a jury to connect with him. Unfortunately, David had suicidal ideations, so he never attempted to commit suicide, but he would imagine his wheelchair rolling down the driveway into traffic. He would imagine being in his wheelchair, having it tip over and causing injury to him. And Gennady, we spoke earlier about things I think that defense counsel, you know, did that I wish they would have done differently. But at one point, Mr. Gangaram, I had examined by a forensic psychologist to talk about his depression, his trauma, his stress, his suicidal ideations. And he conveyed both to Dr. Block, our examining psychologist, and to a jury, different ways in which he thinks about ending his life. And he's on cross-examination, and Bruce Brady said, David, you mentioned to Dr. Block that you imagine your wheelchair rolling down the driveway and onto traffic and getting killed. And David said, I do. And Mr. Brady said, you also mentioned during direct examination with Miss Adamy that you imagine your wheelchair falling over, causing injury to you. And David said, yes, Mr. Brady, I do think that. And Mr. Brady goes, which one is it? Do you imagine your wheelchair going down the driveway, getting you know, hit by a car. And I just like, I don't, you know, it's my gosh. And I think that's where a jury gets angry. Like, this is a fucking guy who, and this came out at trial, Gennady, he said, and I use this on summation or my opening, most people in his situation pray that they get better, that they have a recovery, that they have a meaningful life. David would pray that his God would take him. I mean, I'm getting choked up just telling you the story, but he would pray that his God would take him. And here you have defense counsel who didn't even bother to have David examined by anybody. I had five damages experts that were uncontested because they couldn't bother to send him to anybody. And the best that they have, and I send this to a jury, is cross-examining David about which way he imagines in his mind he wants to take his own life. And so when you talk about a jury being angry between knowing that he had to have changed his record to, you know, not producing the metadata, to minimizing what happened to Dave, to calling ahead, all of this stuff, not calling a radiologist, cross-examining a suicidal paraplegic about the differences in the way he wants to end his life when his wife and two sons are sitting in the courtroom, to me is just, it was upsetting,
distasteful.
And I have to tell you, I hate to say it like this because I felt bad for David, but it worked in our favor. I didn't have to do anything. Bruce just blew that on his own.
You mentioned the number of experts, you had a life care plan, day in the life video, psychiatrist, I believe you brought on. And you've already said they were all uncontested. Did they do any cross-examinations of those experts?
Yeah, we had a neurologist as well, a psychologist, a life care planner, an economist. I think your typical cross-examination in terms of what we call collateral cross. You testify, how many times you testify? You testified 1,000 times, you know, so typical stuff, but not much that was meaningful or relevant at all. You know, they could have called an expert to say he had a decreased life expectancy or diminished life expectancy. They could have called someone to talk about his neuropathic pain, that with a different cocktail of medications. They could, you know, they did nothing, but none of the cross-examination of the damages witness I felt to be anything meaningful that swayed a jury against what the experts had testified to.
And you also had, I was taking a look at the verdict sheet, you had damages for Mrs. Beebe Gangaram for the wife. How did you set that up in your trial?
Yeah, I mean, you know, in the death case, you have someone who no longer has a family member. A lot of cases you have where surgery's gone wrong and our client went through 1, 2, 3 years of hell, and maybe they're doing okay. Mrs. Gangaram's case was so huge because she was his 24/7 caregiver. You know, David wakes up multiple times in the middle of the night, literally writhing in pain. And I hated to do this, but I needed the jury to see how badly, or I should say how profoundly the neuropathic pain affected him during the day and during the night. And the family took this video of him, but, you know, she responds to that. And a jury heard that as of the time of trial and still as of today, they were getting 4 hours of home health care a day. And for 3 years, they were only getting 4 hours a day, 4 days a week. It's only till about a year before trial, which is 2019, 2021, you know, 3 years of essentially 12 hours a week of care. And so the video we showed of the aide getting David from the bed to the wheelchair, when the aide's not there, Beebe is doing that. when he has accidents, you know, he has fecal incontinence. When he has accidents, you know, she's doing that, changing his bag. He had open wounds, an open wound on his leg. She takes care of the wounds. She dresses him. She bathes him. She no longer has a spouse, you know, a husband, a lover, a best friend. And so her derivative claim was a really, really significant part of the case. And Bibi is, I think, she's just an angel, and she's very soft-spoken, and she doesn't like to complain. And she's told the jury, I do what I have to do. You know, this is, you know, this is my husband. And I think they connected with her as well, which she has to do on a daily basis to just give David the basic care is just unbelievable. And a single woman on her own, meaning one person, shouldn't have to do that. And a jury really, really connected her and wanted to compensate her for the services that she now provided to David and the loss of services that he used to provide to her. Companionship, love, intimacy, friendship. You know, part of David's paraplegia, neuropathic pain, depression, is not wanting to be with his wife and his children, even in the same home. And that was really, really impactful in terms of him having to admit with his wife and his children in the first row to a jury that I don't even want to be around them. And that was really tough, and it was tough for them to hear, but her derivative claim was really profound.
Profound to the tune of over $4 million for past services and over $7 million for future services. So that was a big part that I definitely wanted you to bring up, that it's not always about the injured themselves, but those that are around them who are sometimes affected so much greater than the injured person is. And this verdict was just monumentally just, and I'm so happy that you were able to bring the Ngarim family what it is that they deserved. I got to ask you a very important question here, probably the most important of this entire interview.
Sure.
You've built a reputation as one of the strongest voices in courtroom, but it's still a profession that's dominated by men.
I knew you were going to go.
How has that shaped your journey? Do you approach trial work differently because of it or in spite of it? Tell us a little bit about being so incredible in a male-dominated field.
So great question. You know, when I started my career, I was at the Bronx DA's office in 1998. It was completely male-dominated in terms of not only the trial attorneys, but the judges, who my supervisors were, things of that nature. And as the years progressed, it didn't change. I'm not happy to say it's, you know, 2025, so 26 years later, and it really hasn't changed. You know, when I started trying cases in this field, I used to go watch Judy Livingston and Eleni Kafinas, watch their trials. But it was sad that there were a handful of female trial attorneys in this business who were trying cases. It's not like I can walk into any courtroom and find a female trial attorney trying a complex medical malpractice case. So I'm always mindful of my environment. I always read the room. And I can honestly say that when I walk into a mediation, a conference, a deposition, and more importantly, a trial, am I mindful of the fact that there's a room full of men and me? Of course I am. Am I used to that? Of course I am. What my strategy is if I walk into that courtroom and I know every part of my case, every page of every medical record, every medical definition, if in my sleep I can explain to a jury the spinal anatomy, what a spinal infarct is, the MRI, if I can visualize David's MRI and be able to explain that to a jury, if I know the law, if I stand up for an objection and a judge says basis, and I don't sit there and, you know, I don't know, it just doesn't sound right. If you know your client, if you know your case, hit them with that. And I walk into any deposition, any mediation, but most importantly, trial, and I am prepared beyond belief. And I think that that comes out in my conversations with the judge, when I pick a jury, my opening. I think that if you walk into a courtroom prepared, you know your case, that's going to carry you through. That's going to make the difference. And they're not going to say Mary Jo Adamy, the female trial attorney. They're going to say Mary Jo Adamy, the trial attorney who just blew us away with a $60 million verdict, the largest verdict in Nassau County, as opposed to the female trial attorney, right? They're going to talk about my cross-examination skills, how I connected to a jury, my opening, my closing, my cross of the defendant, my experts. And so that's what I will be known for. So, of course, I'm mindful of my environment. I know I'm a minority in a couple of different ways, but I know I'm a minority in this big sea of trial attorneys that we have. I know I might be, depending on the judge, depending on my adversary, in their eyes, a disadvantage. I think I'm an advantage because I know my case better than anybody. There, you will not find anybody who will know their case going into a courtroom the way that I would. I may not win. I may not prevail. I may not have the stronger case, but I will be prepared. And so when I walk into a courtroom, when I start talking, when I give an argument, when I talk to the jury, the judge about the facts, my adversary will say, oh, she actually knows her shit. I actually may have to pay attention on this one and do my job. So I'm mindful of it, but I feel that where I can get the edge and one can get the edge is just, you know, wowing them with what you know and your preparation. And you don't have to be the greatest trial attorney in the country or a legal genius. Know your case, be able to relate to a jury, make an argument, and it makes up for the
everything else. Was so well said. You have to be prepared. You have to be confident. You have to know this case inside out. You have to have case law ready for every objection. And just so beautifully said, there's a reason I brought you on here. You are one of the best. And it's a privilege to have you had open up your playbook to us, walk us through not just the verdict, but the strategy, the heart behind it. This was a new chapter in our trial Bible playbook. And I just want to say thank you. We appreciate you and your willingness to come on to here and share the story for the Giguere family. And it's been great.
Yeah, it's an honor to be here. I'm so glad you asked me. I hope everybody continues to watch these. I think they're very, very helpful. Sorry it took you a while to get me, but this has been great. So thank you.
In a case where a so-called routine procedure turned into a lifetime of disability, the defense may have thought the odds were in their favor, but our guest proved that when you diagnose the fact, treat the evidence with care, and operate with precision in front of a jury, justice has a way of making a full recovery. Thank you for joining us on this chapter of Trial Bible. Until next time, remember, great trial work isn't about quick fixes or band-aids. It's about deep preparation, steady hands, and the courage to cut right to the truth.
That's a wrap for this episode of The Trial Bible. We hope you've gained some valuable insights. Don't forget to subscribe, rate, and review so you never miss an episode packed with winning tactics and expert advice. Thanks for tuning in.